What's today's date anyway?
I have no idea.
You don't have any idea.
Come on. The 16th of August, I think?
No, I think it's the 18th. The 17th?
Sure. I don't know. That's what you asked me. I don't know.
And it's a Wednesday. Or Thursday. Mm-hmm. Thursday morning around 1 o'clock or so?
I think it is the 16th.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yesterday was my father's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. So, we were talking about last night on the phone about the concept of being professional.
No, let's not talk about that.
No, you
I don't want to go there because I tried to explain what I meant by this.
You're giving me the... Well, the idea was psychophobia, if you recall. And your challenges with being an artist, but not a mentally ill artist, or an outsider artist, which I never felt you were either. Are we going there? It's okay if you don't want to go there. I'll go there.
Well, what are you saying? What is
it? No, I'm just saying is that one of the things that...
You're not easing into this very well.
No, I'm not, am I? Yeah. No, well, that's okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, where I'm coming from in my mind is we talked last night about the challenges of being an artist and being you and being identified.
Challenges of being me.
Yeah. You being you.
Everybody's got their own challenges. I don't want to make it seem like all of a sudden I've got this great burden. That sounds kind of wacky.
Isn't that kind of wacky?
Yeah, challenges of being me. Everybody's got their challenges. My challenge is no different than anybody else's, or no greater, or minimized, or so.
Well, I got challenges.
We all have challenges, and different. Challenges is relative. You know, so.
Well, I was just thinking that.
I mean, I'm on SSI. I'm on public assistance. I have very little challenges. I mean, it's hard to kind of live on that, but at the same time, I don't have to struggle as hard as other people to make the rent. You know, I do have to make the rent or pay the bills, but other people really have to kick their ass to pay the bills and feed their kids and pay the car note and pay the mortgage. So, I mean, there are people who have serious challenges. What you're talking about is, you know.
So we all have challenges.
Yes. So maybe you should approach it from something.
Some of them are...
Maybe you should approach it from a different...
Well, where would you like to...
No, I'm just saying that just sounded really, to me, like, who's this guy talking about his challenges? The challenges of being you. I wasn't talking about the challenges. I was just talking to a friend about some of the things that concerned me. But you're going to approach it in a public forum, like, and your challenges, as if, like, anybody gives a damn, you know?
Well, maybe nobody gives a damn.
Right. And nor should they.
But, I kind of wonder
about somebody who's got 2 hours to spend listening to this who probably, you know, would want to hear about my challenges.
Well, who would? No, he's making faces.
This is VO-isms here.
No, when I'm...
Maybe you should turn it off and start again.
No. Let's just keep on going, and we'll just see where it goes.
What? You could always edit this out, because this is definitely...
You don't like it?
It's not...
What?
Come on. See, it's on, and you've got your on...
My on personality.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do have my on. Now, what is my on personality?
And this is more of it.
More of my on.
This is more of
it. How can I?
Yeah.
So if I turn it off, would I be any different?
Yes.
How?
Because you wouldn't be capturing how brilliant you are at cornering somebody.
Oh, right. How brilliant I am at cornering
somebody. It's more about your show than somebody, I think.
You think?
I really do.
You've been listening to me for years, and you're finally figured out that this is not about you, it's about me.
Yeah.
All these documentaries I've been doing on people, it's about how brilliant I am.
It's everything as artists we do is a self-portrait. Even if it's of somebody else, it's a self-portrait.
Right.
So, of course, you inject a more than a healthy dose of yourself in these things.
I do. Yeah. Even though I kind of... you may think that you're subsuming yourself into something and that it's all about your subject, but it is very, especially your style, is very much about that, or else you wouldn't be sitting here asking the questions with you with a mic.
Well, you got a mic too. You can
see, this is, turn it off.
No, this really. This is good.
No, it's not. This isn't life. This is your life. This is me trapped in the spaceship.
You trapped in the
spaceship. This is me trapped in the spaceship. And you're piloting the spaceship.
Well, they still. Okay. Listen, you piloted the laundry machine.
No, don't close it. Don't. That's all.
Well, we're friends. We can have a disagreement. As long as you agree with me, everything's fine.
You know how true that is.
You don't know how true that is. Is how true that is.
You know how true that is.
How is that true? How true is that?
That's very true.
That is very true. Well, I said it. It must be true.
Should I take two?
No. Okay, take two.
I don't like where this is going. And I like, it's like, you have a certain persona sometimes when you're recording that can be not.
You're the only person who's ever said that,
Well, because because other people get blinded by the red light off the tape machine.
That's not red.
That's not red?
No, it's green. Oh, that's red.
Yeah.
But the other ones are green.
But that's, when it but no, but this, that, they get blinded by the red. Well,
I know what you're talking
about. See, this, and I know how you are when you're recording. I've said this to you on numerous occasions. And then you play into it, because it's usually when you're recording that I say this, and you play into it, because you think, oh, this is great, yes. And it's like, that's the whole point of what I'm talking about. It's like you lose a certain part of reality by getting into this non-reality of trying to capture the reality. So it's, what I'm saying? So there's an artifice, and it's not real, and it's all about getting good audio, and it's less and less about the friendship, and less about compassion, and more about, wow, this is great. I've been in documentaries enough to know that's, I've seen how it happens, when someone's taping you and you start getting into some deep emotions, and you can see them lean forward, because they know they're getting some good shit, and it's less about how you feel and more about what they're capturing that will make their name or will make them a force to be reckoned with in the documentary milieu, And that's so I've seen it, and I see it with you.
You see it with me.
I'm sorry, but I do.
Okay.
I just see you kind of lean in when things get hairy or when you start provoking me, and then I bite. And it's like, yeah, I got him now. Yeah, it's like, and it's, what kind of friend is this?
And
the machine. See, that's what I'm talking about. this is good audio for you, and I'm suffering here.
You're suffering.
And the tape is still rolling.
And it's not even tape.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Well, we're really good at seeing other people, but when they see us, we think they must be talking about somebody else.
Sure. I'm a perfect example of that.
No comment.
But I'm being more and more honest with myself, and when people say, you are this, that, the other thing, I guess my experience in the last 20 years, you kind of have to take things with a grain of salt, but at the same time, you have to kind of say, wow, just kind of question yourself sometimes. It's good to be strong in yourself and build a strong sense of self. It's also good to question. And if somebody comes away, it's like the, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And another platitude or cliche is, 50 million Frenchmen can't be wrong. And if enough people are saying, you such and such and so and so, you've got to stop for a moment, pause, not stop, but pause for a moment and say, maybe there's some truth to that. Especially if it's something that's troublesome. You've got to kind of check yourself. And I've learned to do that in the last 20 years. When enough people say, and then sometimes you run afoul of people who kind of want to follow a party line for whatever reasons. And they read something about you, and that becomes a thing they say, and it may not necessarily be rooted. It may not be true. It may be rooted in some element of a truth, but may not be the truth.
You know what I mean? There may be roots of it that kind of are valid, but the end result may not necessarily be the truth. So you got to kind of parse that out and see what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, what fits, what doesn't fit. But it's always good to pause and question who you are, what your motives are. Yeah, and that's one thing I learned in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I call that reality checking.
No, I know you do. I was going to say that, but I don't particularly like that phrase.
No?
No. I think you use it almost like a buzzword. And you've overused it, I think. And I don't particularly like that. You know. Sometimes shorthand isn't very good. When it becomes like an overused buzzword. And that's kind of how pop culture is. Sometimes buzzwords get stale. And it's time to retire it and revert back to, or call it something else, or just be a little more forthright with it. I'm not too fond of that one.
Well, I think sometimes shortcuts are almost like copywriting poetry as a copyright. You try and distill something down to its smallest possible nuance that has a...
Yeah, but that gets stale. Well, it's like slang. Slang doesn't last forever. Yeah? And it may be cool, and I don't even think people say cool anymore. Not people of the current generation. I don't know what they use. But it may be like a hip thing to... hip, that's another one. I use all these old slangs that kind of resonate with me. Not necessarily from like my youth, but also from my father's age. You know, the jazz age, you know, and, it falls in and out of favor, usually out and then forever out. Rarely do you see a resurrection of something. Well, that'd be interesting now that we have documentation of things, of the 20th century. It'd be interesting to see words come back in the 21st century that were hip in the jazz age of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, or 50s, or whatever.
Well, in the 60s, we had dig it. And
I use dig. I dig in it. That goes back to the 50s, the jazz.
Right, it goes back to the jazz guys. But, I mean,
I use that. I use a lot of old phrases.
For me, like with reality checking, I never heard anybody else use that except for me.
In the community, in the mental health community, it's been used. I've heard it. I've never... And I don't know. It just. I don't like how you use it.
Maybe you just don't like me.
No, I love you, but it's I don't know. I just feel like it just doesn't ring true. It doesn't ring true somehow. It's just.
Well, maybe we have so much familiarity that if that's the positive and the cons on it is that we know each other well.
Mm. I just don't like it. I don't like a reality. I just don't like that phrase. Or I don't like it. I feel you use it as kind of like a password to get into the mental health community. Yeah. You know?
Really?
Yes.
Damn. A password.
Yeah. That's your password to get in. Yeah, Joe sent me.
Joe sent
reality me. Check. Yeah, and then they said, "Okay, come in."
Okay, come in. You can come in.
And then
you got the password.
And then you kind of hang out, and, you know, mess your hair, drool a little.
I'm one of the guys.
And one of the guys, and you kind of cozy up to somebody, break out your recorder, take a few pictures, and then go back to your reality.
To my reality check,
yeah,
or unchecking. I hadn't thought of it in those ways.
I see it like that. I see things.
Well, did you feel I was ingenuous?
You mean disingenuous?
Something like that.
Occasionally, not often, but occasionally I felt that you saw access to something that you saw was. For various reasons, you saw it was very genuine, because the mental health community, especially in the art, and the aspects of the art, is very genuine, very real.
very visceral. And you probably want access to that. The emotional heft, the emotional genuineness, is, you probably want access to that. And being a filmmaker and documentarian, you probably saw this was gold. So perhaps you did want to, kind of, like anybody, like Jessica Yu or anybody. I'm not saying that she's disingenuous, but I'm just saying people with any sense who wanted to kind of document something that was real would want to get in there and do whatever they could to get in there and cozy up to and to anybody who that they could to kind of make that happen for them. Now, I'm not saying you necessarily did that with me. Maybe you did. I don't know, unconsciously or subconsciously. I did see you as just a friend, and you proved yourself as... I never even stopped to think, to question you. I just took you in as a friend, and you were a friend. And you made yourself a friend to me first. But then when the tape recorder came out and photographs and all that stuff. But I also see that the fact that you were willing to... jeopardize your situation to document, let me know that it was more than just somebody trying to get something and he was kind of skirting on the outskirts and you kind of got entrenched, or enmeshed and entrenched, like the wartime photographers and wartime journalists.
Embedded,
that's the word. You got embedded, like wartime journalists, which led me to believe that you were for real. Yeah. But over the years, being documented as often as I have, I've come across many people who want to get in there and kind of try to figure out a way to get in there. And you can kind of see those who are like snakes making that snake move side to side to see how they can get in, and people who just walk up face forward, you know, with their back straight, not like a snake saying, hey, I'd like to get in there and be your friend and get to know you. And that's how you presented yourself. But like I said, I've seen other people kind of like, hey, wow, let me see how I can... Yes. Yeah, so you see the snakes and you see the people who walk upright. And so at least I can see them. There are people who are probably far less adept at seeing that and get burned.
Interesting, because 20-some-odd years ago, I went to the Outsider Art Show, the first one,
mm-hmm.
and I was impressed with the whole concept of these... non-artist artists who were being shown. Some of them just had no idea. They were drawing and painting
mm-hmm.
because
they needed to, not because they wanted to.
Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and maybe wanted to, but it was just more like, you know, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, just
and I
straight up art.
I was doing that myself before, mm-hmm. and I was trying to figure out the dynamics of who I was and where I was going. And who, if I was part of some segment of art,
mm-hmm.
and I, for a while I identified in my struggle to identify myself as an artist, as a self-taught artist, which I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've never really taken a lesson
mm-hmm.
in the sense of, even if I took a lesson, it didn't matter. I would always paint the way I have it inside of me.
Well, you felt comfortable. Yeah.
And I went to the Musée d'Orsay in Paris to steal noses because I realized I didn't know how to...
Do noses.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are tough. You have to kind of...
Yeah, so I went around and I tried to do them and then I sat down afterwards and I said, okay, now let's see what I learned. And I went back mm-hmm. to my old noses,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which I'm not really... To me, it's more theater. My paintings, if you haven't noticed, and more, they're to me, each piece is a theater piece. They're not really a painting. I came from theater to painting in some ways, but it's all the same to me. Whether it's theater, painting, photography,
it's art.
Music, it's just your passion at the mm-hmm. moment. It's yeah. your mm-hmm. your intensity, your dreams. It's your cannot not do something. You have to do it. So that's why I came to you, and because I felt, wow, these are people who are like me in some ways. You know, mm-hmm. they're nutcases, but so am I in some mm-hmm. cases. Mm-hmm. You know,
we all have Amishigas, whether we want to admit it or not.
Right.
It's all in just varying degrees.
But now here...
And how you can manage it.
Right. And here's the issue that I think we're both kind of talking and wanted to talk some more about was...
how do we deal with our relationship to ourselves and our relationship to the world, how we see ourselves, how we want others to see you and to see us?
In relation to art or just just in general?
Both. You know, to put a word term on it, you know, psychophobia in the sense of, you know, the world, vulnerability, the world we live in, how we want the world we live in to perceive us, and who and the disguises we wear to make us fit into places.
Well, what are you asking me? Because that's a question you can just ask anybody in any kind of distilled fashion. But I don't know quite what you want me to answer.
No, I'm just wondering, since we had this conversation last night and we decided we would have it.
Well, I went on for like a half hour about stuff. I don't want to resurrect that necessarily because I don't know if I can just tap into that, because that was born out of frustration because I was trying to explain something, and is often the case, yeah, which is I understand why you're probably divorced, is because you're tenacious in that you as much as I wanted to be heard and express what I wanted to say, you're always there with, yes, I hear you, but let me tell you.
But.
And it's like, I don't need to hear the but. Can you hear what I'm saying? Do you grok what I'm telling you? You know, and it's like I just want to be heard and understood. That's a major thing with me. I've even said that to people I've been involved with, that the most important thing to me is to be understood. And if I kind of beat the horse or go on and on and on about something, it's only because I really just want to be. I want total clarity in what I'm saying and how I feel about things. And then when that's fully understood, then we can talk, then we can go on about, but I think it's very important for me to feel that...
You've made an effort to...
I've made an effort to express exactly how I feel. And feelings while emotionally, you know, and thinking, and how my perceptions are on things. That often is the case, you know, arguments get started or get fostered and kind of like extend themselves longer than they need to because people don't understand you or people don't want to understand or there's a misunderstanding. So often a misunderstanding can turn to a terrible argument that just doesn't have to happen. And I hate to argue. I don't argue. I really hate to argue. So I'll put a lot more effort not in arguing but in just trying to explain where I'm coming from and what I meant by this saying, by what I said, or how I feel about this. And then when it's understood, then more often than not, the other person, be they male or female, if there was a dispute, will realize that there was no harm done. That's the most important thing. I want people to understand that there's never any harm done in things I'm trying to say or do. But I sometimes put things across in a way that's forceful, or not forceful, but just and I put things sometimes across in a way that are vehement. There's a lot of vehemence, so I really want to really put across how I'm feeling and just let people know, oh, I feel this way about this, and I'm going to say this, and, you know. Occasionally, there have been arguments that have come out of that, but then I'll kind of go to great lengths to explain what I'm trying to say and let whoever know who got upset know that nothing against you, but I just feel this way, you know. I don't know if this is even important to anybody. This is bullshit. So let's move on. It's just so.
Well, you and I have had an argument where we didn't talk for 6 months.
Yeah, well, I won't go into that because, you know, there was a lot of... See, you're putting on your recorder face. You're putting on your recorder face.
You're
wearing a documentarian cap.
No, I'm just saying, you know, we're talking about arguments. You don't like arguments when you and I had one.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Where we didn't talk for 6 months.
Yeah. I don't want to get into that.
You don't want to get into
it. I'd rather not. Because you have your own opinion on it, and I have my own opinion on it.
Okay, no, I just wanted to point out that there
and was... I understand you more, and I understand you more in full as a husband and as a partner, because we were partners, and we're still partners, but we're partnered in many ways. And there's something about... there's just something about you where it's like, you know, you want to be right, and it's documented. It's okay, just disagree with me, that kind of thing. You want to be right, And there's a thing about me where I don't necessarily want to be right. I very often defer to people, especially people who I believe know more what I'm saying. My thing, though, is that I'm quick to cut and run and go on to the next thing. And I think that's where our argument, I won't go into the details of it, but I was quick to, not quick, but after some deliberation within myself and my financial situation, I was like, okay, cut this off, move on to the next thing. And what I was cutting off was something that you put a lot of time and effort and energy into, and you felt hurt and offended that I was willing to cut it off. And I'm a very cut and run guy. It's like, and that's how I've always been. That's how I function. And I tried to go to great lengths after cutting and running to explain myself, but you didn't want to hear it at the time because you felt hurt, and this feeling of, well, I'm right anyway, so what's he talking? So there was, you know, no, but so I mean, I felt a little misunderstood. I did go to great lengths to try to say, hey, look, I love you, and I hope it doesn't have to be this way, but. And then I'd reiterate and make you mad by saying, but I got to do it. I got to cut and run. And that would just make you more angry. Like, well, yeah, so I understood it. I understood the fight. I understood the argument. And I kind of thought it was interesting. It still makes me bristle a little bit. Like, after we hooked up again and we forgave each other, and you said, you asshole. You know, and that really pissed me off.
Really?
Because you were just, to the very end, you wanted to be right, and I'm the asshole. And that's how I took it. I took it, but I'm just saying, it wasn't about being right or being wrong. It was just like, we were looking at it from two totally different perspectives. And I'm in the same position now that I was back then, where I am, until something happens, hopefully, with the show and group of shows that will be coming up in the next couple of months, that I'm doing with a very wonderful person who's kind of representing the kind who is representing me. If my fortunes turn up, and our fortunes turn up, mine, hers, mine, and others, yours as an extended friend, then things will be great. But right now, things are really tight, really super tight. And I'm thinking that I'm selling my issue. I'm cutting and running. You know, I'm like saying, I got to do this. Got to go. Decision made. And that's how I think. Sometimes you need to be that way and not just deliberate and hold on to stuff that really could better be used getting you in a more solvent and comfortable situation. Because the most important thing to me is being comfortable. I got to be comfortable. I got to know that I'm not going to starve or not know how I'm going to pay the rent or not know how to pay the next phone bill or them have somebody turn off my internet. You know, the few things that I have that are built, I got to know that I can keep the machine going. And I got to do whatever it takes to do that. And so I'm a Gemini and I'm flighty, like a motherfucker. But when it comes time to make a decision, the hand of God comes down and that decision is made, and I will make that decision. And it was hard. I felt the sentimentality of letting go of not only the guitar that we had so many great times with. I know. And also was a wonderful gift I got from a wonderful woman who cared a lot about me and paid a considerable amount of money to get the instrument. But I also saw that I could get some money for that thing. I need the money. So you just got to make those decisions sometimes. You got to make those decisions.
Were you this way when you were in your 20s and in your...
I don't remember myself in my 20s. I don't know who I was. I was still a kid in my 20s. A lot of who I am now was born out of the 20 years I spent locked up in a mental hospital. Here we go. And growing up in that environment and learning how to survive. I didn't know how to survive before then. Clearly, because I ended up in the situation that I was. I didn't know how to survive. I was a kid who was sheltered all his life, coddled by his mother and his family as this artistic genius who could do no wrong. And just let him go because he's eccentric and that's Issa. Let's let him be Issa, you know? To the point where when shit hit the fan, I was fucked up in the game. I knew what I was doing. And I learned how to become a man in a mental hospital. And it's helped me to a certain degree. It's also hampered in that I'm a bit institutionalized, which I hope to grow out of as time progresses. And there are certainly many things I don't know how to do, you know, that will be experiences that will be new and fresh to me, signing a lease, any number of things, getting a car note, any number of things for a while, learning how to use a Metro card was like the challenge in my life when I got out. How do you use it? Do you put this in that way? And I always feared buying. First of all, learning how to buy one, knowing how it's still going up to the machine, just finding out how much to get and what. But learning how to buy one, then being online, getting online at rush hour, and figuring out how to use it. Have people behind you. Come on, come on! Yeah. What are you, stupid? What, you spent 20 years in the middle? Yeah. It's kind of like people exposing me as a relic or as an anachronism. You know, someone who just doesn't know how to, and that taps into something that's always been a fear of mine, which is the fear of being found stupid. Because I'm not stupid. Far from it. But there's an insecurity. A lot of that, I think, comes from the fact that I don't have my degree. You know, I did well in school, more or less. But there's an insecurity. And I don't know if getting my degree would make me a smarter person, but it might improve my self-esteem in knowing that, well, at least I got my degree kind of thing. I'm not an idiot. But I think there is an element that is perpetuated by not having that and spending 20 years in a hospital and not being able, even through a correspondence course, to get my degree. Because there was a period when I was really serious, like, I'm going to get my fucking degree in here. I'm not going to waste any time in here. And I went through all the trouble to get my transcripts and find out how to do it and go to correspondence classes. And because I was locked up and so locked up the way I was at that time that I couldn't do it. Because at some point you do have to meet with your... You do have to come out of your cave and do some kind of flesh pressing and meeting of people. And I was just so locked up at the time that they said, we're afraid we just can't do this right now with you. And also the fact, I think it was discrimination because I had a diagnosis and I was like deep in the system at that time. So that really hurt because I was like gung-ho. I was going to go to school while locked up and get my degree because I knew I had at least another 4 years to go. So I figured I can get my degree in these 4 years or get credits for the year and a half or 2 years that I went and kind of work this out. I thought I'd even get my master's if I can get away with it, but I couldn't do it. And that really pissed me off. And it took the wind out of my sails. And now, 10 years later, maybe even more, I don't want to do it. I don't have the impetus. I don't have the drive. I don't have the desire. So that's kind of like a missed opportunity, maybe. I don't know. But that's like an insecurity of mine. Not being perceived as not as bright as I am.
Where do you think that comes from?
I'm sure it's a childhood thing. I'm sure it's a childhood thing.
I mean, because you were just said about you were coddled, you were this precocious genius as a kid, an artist. You had all these feedback from your mother and your family. That
I don't know. See, this is getting into therapy issues, and I don't know if we want to go there because that's a little, not says too personal and shouldn't get personal, but I don't have the answers to this because I'm still in therapy. I'll be in therapy probably for the rest of my life. And these answers that I don't have. These are questions that are still going unanswered. Why, with all of that encouragement and praise, not only as an artist, as a child artist, but also as a brilliant little kid, which fleshed itself out academically, kind of more or less. I ran out of steam academically when I was molested and as a child by a family member, and but that's a whole other story. And that kind of often happens, actually. You know, I've heard stories about that, and it happened to me. But that doesn't mean I didn't stop reading, but just certain elements of my academia fell by the wayside. Yeah, but maybe that's the issue. Maybe 12 years old, I was molested once at 5, I believe. I don't remember it, but I believe something happened, and definitely again at 12 by a family member. So I think that is the root of it. I think that's the root of it. Somewhere there's a block. Somewhere there's a, you know.
I think it's so. Obviously you're able to do many things quite well.
Well, I do my best. You know, I'm learning to do my best for real. Some people say that but don't really mean it. And for many years I'd say that but I wouldn't be really be doing my best, or I'd be doing my best kind of up to at that point, but I was resting on my laurels a lot. When I was in the hospital, a lot of work I was doing was, okay, this is good, because I'm the guy who did Superman on the Rocks. I'm the guy who did Follow the Leader. I'm the guy who did the Woods of Oz piece. Don't forget that. I'm the guy who did those paintings. So yeah, take this. How much? I want $500 for that. $1,000 for that. See that painting? I did that. So I want, and I demand and command and get a couple of $1,000s for paintings in the middle of my career that were crap. But people would be just blinded by the stuff I was doing when I was really on point, and I'd get away with it. And I realized that was terrible. And just the mediocrity of it was frightening. Frightening.
That's an interesting point you bring up about how success can actually...
Even if it's a modicum of success, which is what it was. I was a non-entity in the art world, really. But in another sense, I was in a film that went all over the world. And people would come from all over the world to see me and my work, as well as the other people in the film. And then they buy it. For what I was asking. Which amazed me, you know, because I'd go to Chelsea, or I'd sneak off, or I'd maybe go on a pass, and they'd say, Issa, what? Issa, who? What? The door is that way. Are you here to fix the sink? You know, I wouldn't get any love in Chelsea or in Soho, at Soho, actually, at the time, when that thing was inside. But then people would come from Austria and Germany and, like, go crazy for my shit. So I don't know. But
you weren't doing your best work.
I wasn't doing my best.
You weren't being true to yourself.
I was in a funk. I was depressed. I was depressed because I was locked up, and I was going through the issue of being locked up and trying real hard to get out and not getting any relief and needing to paint and still painting. But looking back on everything I did up to past a certain point and up to a certain point, it was total garbage. Total garbage. It was only until I got out again that I started to step up and kind of, because I my mood improved. I was out. I was free. But I would say almost everything that I did during that period was substandard in some form or another.
Well, maybe you set yourself up with these impossible standards?
No, but with a few exceptions, like the Cosmic Knockout, there were some of those gigantic loose canvases from the Cosmic Knockout that were really good. Those were really good, which I shouldn't sell, and I haven't, thank God. You know, I was almost selling them for like $200 a piece, which is crazy. But those were good because they were inspired. They were inspired by something very real, you know, what I thought was true love, or love over adversity, and real struggle, you know, and insanity. There's real insanity going on in those paintings. And yet a fine technical precision that coexists with that real insanity, which is quite special. But by and large, aside from those pieces, everything else is substandard and mediocre.
You're not being too hard on yourself?
No. Substandard and mediocre.
You may be the only one who thinks that.
I don't know.
You may be hard on yourself on this one. I wouldn't go that far.
Considering what I'm doing now and what I was doing before that, that middle period, I look at it and go, ooh. There's some stuff that I kind of just shudder and just go, ooh, boy, that's bad. You know? But you're right, because there are people who look at some of them and go, man, if I had the money, I'd buy that. And I go, what? How much money you got? Empty your wallet. You know, let's see what you got. Yeah, you know? Because there's stuff I'd love to get rid of, just to get rid of, and it's stuff that I probably will get rid of soon, just to pay the bills, that I can't bear to look at. But people look at it and go, "Wow, that's a great piece." So I don't know, but I think that they're impressed by the name, and if they see a substandard piece surrounded by three other pieces on a wall that are really fine, you know, it elevates the piece. It will, if it, it, yeah, it'll either look like shit, or it'll look like something done by an artist that was, you know, but, and that's kind of the feeling I get. That I put some really weak pieces surrounded by some really strong pieces, and because it's all the same artists, and it's all so impressive when you get like walls and walls of stuff that look really great. That the one or two or three that are not as great don't look as bad.
But what is it? What's going on there? In terms of your own mind and your own reflection of who you are as an artist,
not everything is gold. Not everything is gold. Only when you reach your 60s, 70s, 80s, when you're at the end of your career as an artist, and the beautiful tapestry of your life is reflected in every piece you do, then I think it all makes sense and it all kind of comes together. But when you're like me, in my late 40s, approaching 50, and kind of like a working artist, an artist in the middle of his career, the pieces don't have the same relevance, I don't think, or significance, and they're just bad pieces, Only later will the bad pieces take on a significance
Well, it's said that an artist should never really talk about their artwork in the sense of...
And you have me talking at length about it right now.
No, so. I'm talking about you. This is about you and your relationship to your art, mm-hmm. and your relationship as an artist to being an artist. And part of that might be that whole kind of concept of psychophobia, how you see yourself as not good enough.
Yeah, we talked about the not being smart enough. I often felt I wasn't black enough, being a child with a cafe au lait complexion and a mother who was even lighter and a grandmother who was white and who didn't want to admit that they were... Just all sorts of like secrets and intrigue in the family about race and this one hates that one because they're darker and this one hates that one because they're lighter and then you got this one who's white and this one who looks white but's not white and all this hella crazy shit going on in the family. So there was a lot of racial conundrums in my family that were born out in me. And growing up, of course, during the late 60s and early 70s, when Black Power was really at its most fervent, and it's like Young, Gifted, and Black was the song that they started singing in an assembly. Young, Gifted, and Black. And I'm like, wow, that's great, and then people looking over like, what are you singing for, white boy? And I'm like, what? but for some of these kids who are as dark as God knows what, or even not as dark, but just more proudly black, and I'm this kid who's like into the Beatles and God knows, and all sorts of other, the Partridge Family, and watching all sorts of white TV and getting interested in culturally ambiguous or at least Caucasoid influenced things just because they interested me, not because they were white or Chinese or anything, but just because I was interested in other cultural things as well as black cultural things. But because it borne itself out in the way I spoke and the way I carried myself, also, I was the enemy during that period. So I was very much as a child shunned by the black kids in my school, and it was a predominantly black neighborhood. A predominantly black school. So I felt very much the outsider going to school. And then walking back from school and being called white boy and white girl even. Because I had curly hair and I was kind of plump and I went through an androgynous phase. So to be a white girl walking home from school, you have no idea how that fucks with you, can you believe that? So it's just crazy, crazy.
You told me a while back about your mother walking behind her grandmother.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, my grandmother, she was of Scottish descent. And she married a Jamaican man, my grandfather. But he was mixed. So there's this white and black and white mix that comes out with my mother, who... Sometimes, when you mix kids, they come out darker, they come out lighter. It's a crapshoot. And my mom came out with straight hair, kind of straightish hair, but she was a little olive skinned. And for my grandmother, who was like red hair and freckles and green eyes and very, very pale, to have this olive-skinned, Greek, Mediterranean kind of ambiguous-looking daughter was a bit of a shame for her in Brooklyn in the 40s, in the predominantly white neighborhood of Brooklyn in the 40s. So my grandmother, when they'd cross the corner to head home, she'd tell my mother, according to my mother, this is a story my mother used to tell me, run up ahead of me. Run up ahead, you know, and after a while it was just like, you know what to do. And after a while it was just like unspoken and she'd just do it to run up ahead of her and run into the house, which was like a house where it could have been many people living there. She just didn't want the neighbors to equate that this dark or darker, not even dark even, because my mother wasn't dark, but this, I guess for the 40s, this dark baby or this dark child was hers. She'd want the neighbors to equate that, so she'd make her run up and walk up ahead of her when they'd round the corner.
And what about your relationship with your grandmother?
She, you know, even though she married a mixed guy,
your mother,
my grandmother,
and your mother married a black
my black man, but my mother, grandmother married a mixed guy in the 20s or 30s, and it didn't work out because he was an alcoholic, my grandfather. But what she was thinking to marry him, I'll never know. But, yeah, she was kind of burned on that. And so she had a lot of, I wouldn't say she was racist, but maybe she was, you know. But she hated my grandfather, my father, and my grandfather. But she hated my father, my mother's choice in her second husband. Her first husband, I believe, was white or mixed.
Your mother's first.
My father, who was like a medical student. Who became a doctor but became an alcoholic as he just became a resident somewhere and lost it all. He just got lost in the drink and he was found on the Bowery, and my mother couldn't really, after having two kids with him, cut him loose, you know. But she'd married her father, basically, another alcoholic. She was taking care of an alcoholic, basically. So she was taking care of her father. It was like a very clearly defined thing. But she married my father, who was like pretty much straight up black and maybe a little bit of Indian, Seminole Indian. But he was a musician, which, you know, for most people means, oh, he's a nigga, ain't working. You know, even though he worked very hard and he always had a job because he was a damn good musician and he had a good work ethic and he always worked to put food on the table and bring up as much as he could just to support the family. But even if you're a working musician, some people say, that nigga ain't working. So my grandmother just never liked him. And she didn't like his children. So she always gave me a hard time. Why is your mouth open? I guess I was a mouth breather as a kid. You know? I had an overbite. And so my mouth was always open as a kid. You know, there's some kids that, you know, has like open mouths. And so she goes, why is your mouth always open? Why is your mouth closed? Close your mouth. Close your mouth. And she'd give me a hard-ass time. Just constantly. I hate to go over there after a while. I hate to go over there. Because I'd always be harangued by her. I couldn't just chill. And it was like an every Sunday thing. My mother had to leave the house. And my father wouldn't go because he wasn't welcome. So we'd go all the way from Queens to Brooklyn to be with Granny for Sunday. Sunday dinner or Sunday lunch or whatever. And she'd just sit and stand in her kitchen, complaining to my mother about my father, and then picking on the kids when she got tired of picking on the father. And it was just crazy. It was just crazy. Not a very nice woman. But she was bitter because her marriage ended, and she was alone. She never remarried, never dated. Super Catholic. So she had her own issues that she took out on everybody else.
When I'm thinking and listening about, here you are, a light-skinned black man.
I wouldn't even say I'm that light.
Yeah, I wouldn't either, but that's beside the point.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say that.
But you're not,
I'm not dark, but I mean, comparatively, I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm light-skinned, really. I guess I am, but I don't know, I don't know. Well, medium.
Right, but the where I'm going is,
I've seen some light-skinned brothers.
Yeah. No, we've seen all different colors of the rainbow. Where I'm going with this is looking at your insecurity, as you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That being, as a kid growing up, not a girly artist. Not girly, androgynous.
Just sensitive. Just sensitive.
Sensitive. No, but I'm just saying, using your terms.
Well, yeah, they call me a girl. Like, I walk down the street. Are you a boy or a girl? A boy or a girl?
So here you are. You still battling, am I good enough? Your own identity.
Yeah, but I'm growing out of it. I'm probably at 50, another 3 years, I'll wash that off my back and have middle age to contend with. I'm washing a lot of that off my back.
But you understand where I'm coming from, more than
you realize.
In your struggle and internal of trying to prove that you're good enough, a lot of women go through that too, because it's a male world, so they have to go overboard to prove that they're good enough. Now, here you
black
are,
people.
a black man, you've
got to be 10 times better than the white man to even be considered. You know, I'm kicking ass as an artist, and there are people who, I don't want to get into it, but you just got to be 10 times better, 10 times smarter, 10 times more resilient.
So you're never going to be good enough if you have that attitude.
What do you mean by that?
Well, when are you good enough to yourself?
It's a dichotomous thing, because at the same time, it's like what my friend Katie, and who you know, I don't know how to refer to her. But it's these two characters. It's Captain Nebbish and Superstud. Captain Nebbish is always doubting himself and not thinking he's good enough, and kind of like, I don't know, second guessing. And Superstud is the master of the universe. And it's a dichotomous. I mean, there's also a part of me that knows I'm a bad motherfucker.
Well, what do you mean?
I'm a force to be reckoned with. I'm forced to contend with. There's a part of me that understands what I'm capable of and realizes that potential. Then there's another part of me that just is doubtful and insecure. You just got to figure out which one you're talking to.
Which of the many variants of the iterations you are. But I think that's an interesting observation in terms of what you were saying earlier, that maybe this is, you're never going to feel good enough.
No, I don't know about that. Like I said, I think I said that. I'm washing a lot of that off my back as we speak. Just getting out of, I mean, it's a major blow to your self-esteem to spend time in a mental hospital. Because already you're damaged goods, you know. But getting out and meeting with people and being an equal and even more than an equal with some people, you realize, okay, you just kind of find your way. And it's a major ability of self-esteem, that situation. But once getting out and realizing that, okay, build up your reserve of self-esteem, you realize you're doing pretty good. So
I have a question here. And it's a three-part question. As a kid growing up, as this precocious kid, how did you see yourself then? And then how did you see yourself when you were going through the process?
I don't think about that. I don't remember too much about how I saw myself back then. It's been such a major shift, and I've suffered major brain shakeup going through at least three and maybe four major psychotic breakdowns. Probably four, I think. One definite, and others that were also pretty, and one other that was pretty profound, and maybe two others that were less, but still. And that's like brain damage. So there's a lot of stuff that I won't say I necessarily forget, but having gone through that, and then the recovery process, and then having to recover in a situation where you don't want to be, and you don't think you belong, and you have to fight your way to get out,
And oh my God, what did I do to get here in the first place that you got to deal with? So all of that, having to deal with that, I don't really think about life before the whole thing happened. I mean, I have memories of it. And it's not that I don't remember, but I don't have emotional memories of what I was like as a kid, really. I wrote a lot about it, but at the same time, from an archaeologist's point of view and not from someone who lived it, you know? Because it's all lost in a weird way. And it's okay, you know? I remember my mom, I remember my family, I remember the things I did. I remember with crystal clarity, but almost like watching a film, not as if I was there, you know? And it's okay. I very much suffer from the spectator syndrome. But there's something about being the spectator in that I think your memory's clearer. Or you can remember exactly what color the t-shirt and boots you were wearing in first grade or in kindergarten, you know, as opposed to having this other memory that's more emotional and much more, maybe, you know, emotionally impactful, but fuzzy on the details. But some people, I don't know, some people remember things differently, I don't know. But, I don't know, yeah, I don't remember too much about how I saw myself. I was just there. I don't think about a lot of things. And maybe it's true for how I was as a youngster as well. I didn't think about things. I just kind of, it's more of an intuitive thing. I think I may have said that some other time. I'm not a thinker. I intuit. I don't think. And then maybe that has something to do with why I feel like I'm not smart enough. Because there are people I know who cogitate, who kind of like, and they're thinking. They're burning that wood. And you can tell they're thinking and putting concepts together and it's clicking together like a puzzle. But I don't do that. I just wait for things to come and so and drift in and let me allow me to catch it and produce and put that on a canvas, and then I just wait for the next one. But I don't really think, and that's a weird thing. I'm not a thinker, but there's an element where things kind of, and I've always been a dreamer as a child, and that's what it is. I'm a dreamer and I catch dreams, but I don't think. And I recognize that, and that's what makes me think that I'm not as smart as I should be. Because there's definitely a lot going on in those dreams. And I can remember dreams like reading a script, you know? My dreams are very detailed. So there's a lot going on, and there's like a thought process of sorts, but I don't necessarily think like some people think, or I should be thinking. But that's just how I function.
Talking about dreams, do you have recurrent dreams, or are they always different, or are they in Technicolor?
They're in color sometimes. They're in black and white sometimes. I remember there are colors that definitely stand out. There are colors that stand out. You know, they're like movies. They're like little bits of parts of a movie or an ongoing TV show, but a very high-end TV show.
High-end.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Want to.
Oh, like they spent a lot of money on it.
They spent a lot of money on your dream. the tweaking.
Oh, the, man, yeah.
Is that diagnosable?
No, I don't think so.
But is there any thread that goes through them?
Not necessarily. Just me. It's my life. I'm the common denominator. I'm the common thread. And people kind of come in and out. For a long time, I was dreaming about my nephew because I missed him. And for all the time while I was in the hospital dreaming about him, he was always 18 years old, 17, 18 years old, the last time at the last age I saw him. And he was unchanged. Until I went online, found him, and found videos of him performing, singing, and pictures of him, and realized, why? He's 40, God knows what now. He's like 42 or whatever. And I realized, okay, yeah, let's let that go. Let's let that dream go. And I did let it go. Once I got to see that he'd grown and matured and was okay. But I always kind of felt like I was taking care of him in the house as like a de facto younger brother, which he was, more so than just a nephew. He was a younger brother.
But once I realized that he'd grown and probably had his own life and his own marriage and his own whatever, and his own career.
You stopped dreaming about
him. I stopped dreaming about him, yeah.
But you dreamt about him that whole time until you were able
until to I got on. To see, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Any other dream?
Those are probably the ones that stand out the most. Dreaming of him and wondering if he was okay. Yeah, but he was okay. He did okay. So it was just that's once I realized he was okay, you just let him go and let him travel his road and not hold his hand psychically in your dreams and hold on to him and try to make sure he's okay or make sure. Yeah.
So this may be off. But you dream about your mother?
Not as often as I used to. I used to dream about her a lot, and it was always very pleasant. Initially, the first couple of dreams, she was angry and kind of, you know, or just wondering, or just coming to see me and just kind of like, yeah. And then the anger would subside, and she'd just kind of be tending a garden outside, or hanging out with God, or hanging out in heaven, tending a garden, and I'd come see her, and she'd impart a little bit of wisdom. I mean, I'd go back home. I'd find her someplace. And I said, "Ma, you gotta get me out of here. I'm in a mental hospital, Ma." And she'd say, "I know. I know. You'll figure it out. Gotta go. Gotta go." And I said, "What do you mean you gotta go? No, I don't have to go. You gotta go. Bye bye. You gotta go. Go back." And she'd send me back to reality from the dream. You know? And she said, "You'll figure it out." So I'd come see her, and I'd see her in my dreams. I'd find her, and I'd plead with her, "Ma, get me out of here. Get me out of here." Not yet. Not yet. And it's weird, because since I've gotten out, I haven't had any dreams about her. And I really feel like she's present in my life. She's more present in my waking moments. And it's like I talk to her. I usually after I finish a great painting or finish a song that is a really good one, and I feel like, you know, I had help with this.
Really?
And I'll say, "Thank you, Ma." It sounds like, I don't know if I'm exposing too much, but I'll say it anyway. I'll look out the window, and it's probably like 2 or 3 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I'll just look up and kind of pray a little, or just put my hands together and say, "Thank you, Ma. Thank you, Ma." And then I'd hear a voice in my head say, "Thank God." As if she's saying, "Not just me." And I'd say, "Thank you, God. Thank you, Mom. Thank you, God. Thank you." And I'd say that like a few times to her. "Thank you, Mom. Thank you, God. Thank you, Mom. Thank you, God." Whenever I'd finish a particularly any piece, really, because the piece I've been doing consistently now have been so good one after the other. It's not like I don't say it after one and say it after ones I think I need. Every one I say, "Thank you, Mom," for just kind of like inspiring it and holding my hand through it and doing what she did when I was a kid and growing up. Just like popping into my room every once in a while when I was working on a piece and just saying, "That looks nice. Those colors are nice. Look at the shading. It's interesting." She would always kind of like comment and encourage. Always. She'd never put down anything I ever did as an artist. And she'd always encourage and just kind of give me sometimes a little feedback, helpful feedback, to take it where it needed to go. And she's still doing that. And, you know, in a spiritual sense. In a very real sense. So I thank her. Because she's with me. Yeah, she's with me all the time. She's probably tending the garden now. I don't feel her right now. She doesn't like that.
Did you have a garden growing up?
Mm-hmm.
What'd she grow?
She was everything. Tomatoes, squash, zucchini. She was very green before green was hip. Or kind of like right on the cusp of the hippie and post-hippie 70s movement. Mm. She was very much into that. I remember very much, more so like than the late 60s, because I was too young to really remember, even though she was doing stuff in the garden. But in the 70s, as I become more conscious, she was always in the garden growing stuff. We harvested every year. We ate a lot of the stuff out of our own garden. And it got so popular that people from the neighborhood would come over and ask to, you know, and she was the kind of person who wouldn't charge money, but would charge favors or do things in kind or whatever. So yeah, she was cool. Do things for pot. If there was somebody who had a good pot connection, she grew her own. But there was something up with our soil, so we couldn't grow it as well. as other people who, so she'd work out some kind of deals like that. But yeah, it was great. It's great.
Talk to me a little bit about the pot. How much they smoked? How often they smoked? Were
they smoked. They smoked. They were pot smokers.
Did they wake up smoking?
They were smokers. They were pot smokers.
And you, when you were smoking pot, what was your pot like?
I was a pot smoker.
I mean, did you smoke? How many times did you smoke a day?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. If you're smoking pot, you're getting high. You know, it depends on your constitution. Some people smoke a little bit because all they need is a little bit. Some people smoke a lot because they like to smoke a lot and they need a lot. Or who knows? But I was smoking pot. I was a pot smoker.
But that was a trigger that got you.
Yeah.
What were you like when you were stoned?
I don't remember. I towards the end, I just got paranoid and I got bizarre. Eventually, I got psychotic. But I kept it as a dirty secret. I never smoked with my parents. I never smoked with my mom. It was like a badge of honor in the neighborhood to smoke with my mom. But I never smoked with her. You know? Never smoked with her. I just kept it like a dirty secret and light up in my room and play loud music and dance around like a freak and maybe do some artwork. Maybe, if I was lucky.
Did you... How long did you smoke for?
About 2 years.
2 years?
About 2 years.
And you try to get help from your sister, you mentioned.
From various people, yeah.
And they just told you to smoke more?
Yeah, well, the people I went to were pot smokers. I just knew I was smoking too much and it was affecting me negatively. I wasn't getting high and enjoying it. You know, I just had a very bad feel. I just felt like I was out of control with it. And that if I didn't want to smoke, I realized I couldn't not smoke. I found myself realizing, I gotta smoke, which is like an addiction. And it's one thing to be into your pot and smoke it and know that you can leave it alone. And there's some people who have relationships with pot like that. They like to smoke. They love to smoke. And they smoke it, and they get what they get out of it, and they cannot smoke, and they have that relationship with it. But with me, I was realizing that I couldn't not smoke, and it was like always on my mind, and I was addicted to it. It was definitely an addiction.
Even though you just smoked for 2 years and you didn't.
But what difference does 2 years make? I don't know what you're going.
No, I'm just saying you didn't start smoking until you're 23 or something.
That doesn't matter when you start smoking with anything. Some people, you know, it's like
anything.
You
didn't even like the smoke and the relationship to your family.
Well, I didn't understand it. I just had a contentious relationship with it. I had a contentious relationship. Maybe a lot of it may have had to do with the fact that it took precedence over me. And maybe I just wanted more attention, and they didn't want to give me the attention because they were too busy smoking. You know? I did want a lot of attention as a child. I got a lot of attention, but I did get jealous when I didn't get all the attention I felt I needed to get. And sometimes I didn't get all that attention because they were smoking, trying to get smoke. Or smoking with a group of people, and I'm running around the house trying to impress them with this, that, or the other thing as a kid. And they're like, "Yes, that's very good. Pass that. That's very good. Roll that up. Pass. That's very good. Yes. And then meanwhile, they're sifting through the seeds and the stems. You know, kind of. I remember feeling jealous about that.
But
so pot was like the other child. And there was no room for another child in that house.
Even though you had four or five?
No, but I was the main child in that house. Make no mistake. And then I realized as a child that there's another child named Mary Jane.
Mary Jane, know? Marijuana.
and I was very jealous about that. Very jealous about that. And it reached a point where I kind of realized that that child took precedence over me.
How old were you?
About 12 or 13.
But did you have any idea that you were somewhat unstable as a kid in terms of your eventual diagnosis?
Yeah. I was always looked at as an eccentric kid. And I was, at 12 and 13, I probably was a little bit crazy as a kid. Probably driven crazy by the molestation at 5. Which I don't remember, but I think something happened and kind of fucked me up. And then getting molested at 12 by a family member, which wasn't a penetration. Neither of them were penetrations, I don't believe. Certainly not the second one. The first one, I don't remember. I don't believe so. But they're not violations in that sense, but there was so much of a violation to me in a sense, in another sense, that it just fucked my mind up. It just fucked my mind up. Now, I think it affected my academic career. It affected so much. My emotional state. I became sullen and inward, and I wasn't like this happy-go-lucky kid anymore. I think that's what drove me crazy. I think I was crazy already and building up to the big blow that just happened. Maybe because of the pot, maybe. I think without the pot, I would have gone insane, to be honest with you. But the pot just kind of like open the door. The monster was already beating it down. The monster was already beating that door down.
Just on a sidebar, what's your thoughts on marijuana now and pot?
I don't begrudge anybody. I don't want to become this person who will be picked up as somebody who's beating a drum against pot smoking, you know, because it helped my dad in his last stages of cancer, you know. When he had the cancer and he stopped smoking everything for a while to try to, like, stave it off and think that he could survive it. And then when they said, you know, you're going to die, so do what you want to do. And I saw how the only moments of or extended periods of happiness and contentment and relief he had from the pain and the sadness of his cancer was when he was smoking pot with my mom and with the family. So, you know, and other people, I'm sure, recognize the positive effects of that medically. And I don't have an opinion one way or the other. I used to be very anti pot. Because I didn't understand. I didn't understand myself and my relationship to it and just talking to you and realizing I was jealous of it. You know? More so than what it did to them because, while I feel it kind of made them a little bit out of contact with me, they did the best they could. They did the best they could. You know, I know that when they weren't stoned, they were always uptight, you know, and just, you know. And I don't know what that is. I guess we're all uptight, individuals, people living in the society we're living in. So whatever it takes to kind of make you a little less uptight. And I guess she had her issues, my mother, come from the family that she came from. My father had his issues. The man never knew his father and displaced and so they, like many, like everybody else, have their issues. And they ameliorated those issues the best way they could. But the way they chose to do it was forming a union amongst themselves and smoking pot. And living this artistic, bohemian lifestyle and creating this household for them to have this lifestyle. And it got them by. And they stayed together. So I don't know. And they seemed happy. I was unhappy for whatever reasons because I think the molestation had a lot to do with that. More than I think I've ever given credit for or given voice to.
We've hardly ever talked about
Well, I don't want to turn into, keep mentioning it as if to say, like, I was, like, reamed every day for 6 months by some big white guy with a 12-inch penis, you know. Although that sounds really bizarre. I shouldn't have said that because maybe somebody's gone through that. I don't mean to make light of it. But I'm just saying, it was, considering how some people have been molested and raped, I got off easy. And most of society have been raped and molested in a terrible way. So it's not like a secret that not everybody or most everybody hasn't in some way endured. But considering what some people have gone through, I got off easy. Trust me. But still, it affected me in a very negative way, in a very profound way. And also, around the same time that I was molested, I kind of peeked my head out to my family, maybe looking for a solace and saying, I got molested. Hey, Issa, the kid. The number one kid got molested by a relative. What are we going to do about that? We're going to smoke, kid. We're going to smoke. And I don't know. Maybe I felt like something more could have or should have been done. I certainly feel that way about my mother, who I told about it. And here comes a very key moment. Please stop fiddling with that.
You want me to?
Please stop fiddling with that.
Go ahead.
No, a key moment is the fact that I told my mother the first time it happened with her cousin who molested me, came into my back room while I was drawing at my drawing table, which is why I have such an ambivalent and strange connection to art and my issues, because the one thing that I needed to survive and always had to survive was my art. And just as I was in my room, at my survival, in my fortress of solitude, this motherfucker comes in, puts his hand up my shirt, and starts feeling up my chest, and saying, are you a boy or a girl? Squeezing me up. Which is a return to something I'd heard all my life up to that point. And to have him come in and say that was just like, oh, not you too, you know. And then I told my mother right after it happened, and she didn't believe me. Which allowed him to come in the week later and do it again. After which I told her, and she said, okay, I'm going to make sure he doesn't come back. But the fact that he had a second opportunity to do that really just blows my mind and fucks my whole shit up. And it really kind of creates a love-hate relationship with my mother. You know, I love her dearly, and I love her deeply, and she's very much a part of who I am, and is a source of unending happiness. But also, she missed the boat on that. She missed the boat on that. And she allowed this terrible violation to happen twice, you know, 1 week after. So, I don't know. So that's a major issue. That's a major therapy issue right there. She didn't believe me.
That was what really got you.
She didn't believe me.
Well, maybe but
I understood. I understood because she had no family. Like my father, they were only children, and so they just had their mother and their father. And the fact that both of them came from broken homes and only children, they only had one parent usually in the house, and maybe but very little. No aunts, no uncles, no cousins. So somewhere in the 70s, when Roots was hip and happening, and people like looking up people from all over the world to kind of be their family. She started finding people from Jamaica and various other places, Toronto, Canada, England, who were family. And she was reconnecting and kind of like building this familial network. And some of them were motherfuckers, like this guy.
Oh, so you didn't know this guy very well?
I know him at all. Hardly. He just showed up like when I was 8 or 9 years old. This is Cousin Tun. Oh, hi, how are you? And he had kids, so heaven only knows what he was doing to them. Boy and male and female children. My age. So heaven only knows how fucked up they must be. But, yeah, I know these people. We didn't know anybody. Except us. The five kids and the two mother and father until like the early and mid-70s. When she started looking people up. And then she encouraged my father to look people up. We even took many trips to Florida to find family and realize there was no family. There was no family. He had no family. Which hurt him really deeply. You know, the fact that he had no connections. Yeah. But she had shitloads of connections all over the world. Jamaica, England, Toronto, Canada, well, various places. And the good thing about it is I ended up traveling and seeing all those places because there was family there now. So she'd send me for one summer here, one summer there, one summer. So that was a good thing.
Well, it sounds like you never forgave your mother for...
It's hard. It's
not
hard.
Not believing you.
It's hard. But it sticks. It stays. I don't say I didn't never forgave her, but it stays with me. It stays with me. I wouldn't say I don't forgive her, but it's just very painful because that's a very profound moment in my life that it's still reverberating, and it's not even so much demolestation because it's not like I was penetrated and that which causes any kind of molestation or violation is terrible. Excuse me. But like I said, he just came in, stuck his hand up my shirt, felt my breasts, felt my chest. Are you a boy or a girl? Are you a boy or a girl? I'm a boy. Are you sure? Are you sure? Yeah. And then he'd leave. Which is minor. It's bad, but it's not like he's sticking his middle finger up my ass or something, yeah. Or worse. But just the fact that she didn't believe me, that is worse. That's what makes the violation all the more impactful. So it's not so much the violation or the molestation. It's the fact that she didn't believe me. That's what hurts. But I understand. And she didn't want to lose this guy. She didn't want to, like, create a rift. And after not having people for 30-some-odd years and then gathering people and still in the process of gathering people, she didn't want to be in a position of saying, well, okay, I'm gathering, but you, I can't deal with that. You know, she didn't quite know how or necessarily want to. She ended up having to do that. But for that first time, it was like, oh.
So did he come back or?
No, he didn't. He didn't. Thank God he said something and he didn't come around.
Was he in the neighborhood?
He was in Queens somewhere. I think we went to his house once. Interesting story. He was dealing with a woman. I don't know if it was his wife. I think it was his wife, but it could have been a girlfriend. But something went down, and he got cut in his face with a knife. Some female cut him, and that felt good.
Oh, after you?
After it happened.
How did you hear about that?
I heard about it, and I got to see him once. I think we went to his house. I saw this big scar on his cheek, running from like his temple down to his neck or something, like a serious scar. They did a serious number on him. And that was like, okay, yeah, this guy's a motherfucker and he molested children. He molested me. He's probably molesting his own kids. He's probably doing a lot of dirty business with his women, too. She probably caught him with somebody else. So he deserved that. So that was vindicating. That was vindicating.
At the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember feeling anything about it. I don't feel anything about it now, but I think as a child, I was like, it just made sense. It was just like retribution. There's a certain sense of justice that children have. Like, I don't know. I could be talking out of my hat, but I think children don't get emotionally about it as adults do. And it's just like, okay, he got his. And it just marked him in a weird way as a real piece of shit. That's your mark. You've been marked, motherfucker. And you got what you deserve. And so, yeah, I just left it alone after that. I think most children kind of... Oh, certainly I did. I'm not going to say most children. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. I don't know the first thing about children. I just know about my own childhood. And that's definitely how I felt. It was just like, done deal. Yeah. And I didn't think about it after for years afterward.
But yet it was a kind of a defining moment in your life at the time.
What, him getting cut or my getting molested?
The whole circumstance obviously is...
You know, a very defining moment. Very defining moment, yeah. Even more so than thinking I got, believing I got molested, but not remembering it in Head Start at like 4 years old, 3 and 4 years old, I think it was 4 years old. More so than that, Like I say, at 12, because my mom didn't believe me.
That's
what it was. That's what was the major blow. And she allowed it to happen again. Or I won't say she, but it happened again because she let him in the house again. And he crept in the back. Probably said, let me go check out the young artist, as they all probably did when they came in. See what the young artist is working on. And he came in and put his hands up my shirt again. Terrible.
Did you feel as you think that kind of snowballed?
Yeah, I think we discussed that. Yeah, definitely. 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 And there was a period when going through this, God knows I had 20 years of therapy and 20 years of self-inspection. And there was a period where I thought to myself, wait a minute. Is it possible that I never forgave my mother? And what happened as an accident wasn't really an accident. You know, you kind of like play those games with yourself. Like, was there like a set of circumstances kind of? That, and you kind of play that. But I, knowing what happened, I know it was an accident. But it's just kind of almost like, what's the word I'm trying to say? I don't know. There's an expression or a word or a set of circumstances where poetic. A poetic justice, almost, in a weird, weird, terrible, terrible way. In a terrible, terrible way, but almost a poetic justice in it. That I don't look at it like that, but that for a brief moment I thought to myself, well, if it was an accident, which it was, then what kind of karma kind of allowed for this to happen, you know? Like, you know. You fucked this child's life up because you thought it was more important to hold on to this piece of shit in your family and allow this guy to come back and molest him again. So, I mean, just crazy. You know, but who's to say how life turns out? God probably is probably, you know, if that, who knows? You know, I think about things like that. I think about things like that, like the purposeful things, or things that happen on purpose, or things that happen for a reason. And things do happen for a reason, I really firmly believe. And I think that maybe that was another case of it, if things do happen for a reason. There are accidents, and then are there really accidents? There's like a whole 90% of the brain that we're not using. Or things are going on that we have no idea what's happening. That is all a part, and who knows what 90% I'm using, or what 90% she's using, or you're using, and how it all comes together. And maybe it all just came together. And who's to say in that other 90% there's another percentage of that that's God? I know you don't like to go there, so I won't go there with you because you don't like to go there. But who's to say? You don't know. You don't know. And God is a concept, yes, that's probably man-made and created, but who gave them the concept to think about God? But maybe who's to, you know? I mean, if you were to consider that for a moment, that there is a system of justice that is higher than the one that they allowed us to create here on Earth, and maybe there is a karma, and maybe for that reason, for some reason that I still haven't figured out, something allowed that to happen. As an accident, so that I wouldn't be so fucked up about it, and can then use that experience, and things, yeah, it just boggles the mind how it works out, and if it will work out, you know, like, but it's all interconnected and interlaced in its own kind of spiritual, godly way, karmic way, for something that happened when I was 12, and other, who knows what else. But there are people who believe that. So who's to say that what people believe that are like right-wing crazy aren't necessarily right-wing crazy, but true in its own way? So I just find myself thinking about that sometimes, and not necessarily driving myself crazy with it, but just kind of like taking a time. I take time. Now you're getting into my thought process. This is what I think about. I say I don't think. What I do think, this is what I think about, this kind of stuff, like what if stuff. And that plays a very big part in what I paint. What if? What if?
what if? Like, what are the possibilities of this, that, and the other kind of coming together? And that's what I paint. When I do think, it's always like, what if stuff that would never happen in reality? So I try to paint it. If it's at all possible. And I don't know if I even scratch the surface of the things I think about in when I think about those things and kind of put it in a way where it makes sense, like how I think about it. Because the mind is so multi-layered that as you think stuff, you're also thinking other stuff, and it's all interlaced in the mind. But to somehow capture that on a piece of paper, in a phrase, or even in a book, or even in a painting, is nearly impossible. Or in a film, you'd have to have 3 or 4 screens of the same film running at the same time, which is an interesting idea, to kind of get the idea of what the brain is thinking, or what the artist or the director or the writer of the film is thinking, and then putting it all together. And that's kind of how I think is the challenge of me as an artist, or as an artist, and me in particular as an artist. So I don't know how successful, and maybe that's why my stuff is so surrealist, because it's so bizarre, because you're thinking on different levels. You're thinking on the real level. You're thinking on this other level, and maybe 2 or 3 other levels that are based in reality, others based in metaphor, and using cartoon characters, who God knows where that comes from, you know, but you're kind of throwing that into the mix. And then it's like personal, because you're in there, you got a picture of you in there holding your nose or whatever, yeah, and so it's like on so many different levels. But that's what I'm trying to do, to try to piece it all together and have it all make sense. And that's why I say it's all a part of the tapestry of our lives and the quilt of who we are. And at the end, it will all make sense. Certainly, I feel that in my case, whether it's true for other artists or conceptual artists who are doing like big red dots on white canvases. What the fuck that means, I don't know. And how that will make sense at the end of their career, who's to say? But I definitely believe, going through what I've gone through, believing to a certain degree in art therapy or just the revelatory aspects of art, of a person's life in their art, I think certainly by the time I'm 60, 70, 80, or time to check out, if we were to put it all together, it would all make sense. Or at least I'd have the corners of the puzzle.
Well, I marinating that thought of what if, because I do that too in myself and in my art, and I can sense that in your paintings, now that you've articulated it. And I can sense how that could drive you crazy too.
I don't think it drives me crazy. Thank God I'm on something, and who knows, it could be a placebo. You know, this shot I'm taking is just something that's like a painful placebo, something I get every month that hurts like a bitch for a couple of days, but isn't really helping me one way or the other, and I'm kind of straight. Who's to say? I've, that's another thing I think about that's kind of a question of driving yourself crazy. But if it is working, and the medication's keeping me stable and sane, which God knows it's doing, or something is doing that, I am stable and sane, thank God. Then I don't think I'm driving myself crazy. I'm allowing myself to kind of think as far as I can fling myself and not get too far where I can't reel myself back in and say, okay, I'm okay again. Yeah. Time to eat. Time to sleep. Time to bathe yourself, clean yourself, wash your clothes. You know. But when it's time to think that far out stuff, I can go there, but I can also reel myself back in. I know insanity for me was not being able to reel myself back in and let those thoughts get further and further flung until you're flinging over the cliff and falling with it and thinking not only that nothing will catch you, but that you can fly. You're going over the cliff and at some point you're going to take flight. And it never happened, unfortunately. But
so. We know a guy who tried to fly off the 6th floor.
Who's that?
Jose.
Jose.
The Fly.
Who's that? Which Jose?
He did a, he was doing a...
Which Jose?
He was doing a cartoon, a comic.
Oh, the comic guy. He did a thing. I didn't hear that. I may have heard that. I don't know. Is he dead?
No. He screwed himself, his body up.
Oh, yeah.
wound up in the mental hospital, but he was on some marijuana or something.
PCP, I think it was.
And he jumped off. He thought he could fly.
Yeah. He was a good kid, though. He tried hard.
I don't know where he is. Have you heard anything?
He disappeared. He got very discouraged. They were putting him through school at SVA, and he realized that while he, as an outside artist, he was okay. As an artist going to SVA, which is a professional school, he didn't quite measure up. And he got very disillusioned and disappointed in himself. See, going there with people who probably were touched in some way, as all artists are, but a little more grounded in reality and producing really fine work. And he's doing these cartoons that were kind of rudimentary and crude and not even good. No, I don't say good, but not even standard, let's just say, comic book cartoon fare. You know, he got disillusioned and then stopped going. Well, his grade suffered and realized it wasn't for him.
Do you think that in your instance of your own insecurity, going back to that, that maybe that's a natural thing?
Probably. I'm sure a lot of people are insecure. I'm sure Donald Trump doesn't think he has a big enough penis. You know? I mean, everybody's insecure, I think. Even those who... That's what narcissism also is about. It's a moment of masking your insecurity, overlaying with a whole lot of bluster to hide your insecurities. I mean, even those who seem like they're the masters of the universe, as with Mo, my dominatrix friend, the masters of the universe who, like, had everything and more, would come to her on Thursday or Friday, usually Thursday, because Friday they'd spend it with the family and do their weekend thing. So on Thursday, they'd show up and say, "Let me eat your shit, mistress. Let me walk on me, mistress. Just total power exchange. Total power." And she'd beat the shit out of him, and total insecurity. So everybody's got their own insecurities. I don't think we just happen to be talking about mine and going in depth and in detail with it. But everybody's got their own insecurities. And it would be a shock for some people to hear my insecurities, especially about my art, especially people who've seen my art, or people who know me and see me bring pieces in like every other day, and they're really good. And they'd be like, "What? He feels that way?" Because it's like some of the pieces are very, very good, I have to admit. And even the stuff that isn't very good, or even the stuff that I don't think is very good, is better than some people's best. You know? So some people would be shocked or just curious why I would feel so insecure about certain things, especially my art or myself. But everybody's got their own insecurities. That's what makes us human.
You know, interesting, last night we were talking about your observations of how you want people to see you. How do you see yourself now?
I don't really see myself too much. I don't get bogged down, and I've grown to a degree or matured to a level where so much of the experience in being locked up in a mental hospital for 20 years is how they're perceiving me, you know? So much of that experience is don't be crazy, you know? Don't be a sexual predator. Don't be whatever it is that they may have mentioned in passing they think that you are. God's sake, don't be that, don't be this, don't be that, don't be this. And you kind of neglect or forget about being yourself or being who you are. And it's a question of not being perceived as this, that, or the other thing, because you know that's bad and that will slow you down or maybe not keep you from getting out altogether. But since I've gotten out, I don't concern myself with how I'm perceived or, you know, I wear my hair loose. I wear my hair, in a natural freestyle. And there are times I don't shave and I grow a beard and I feel cool with that. And I'll wear whatever I feel like wearing. And I feel very secure in many ways. Even though I have my insecurities, which are kind of holdovers from childhood and then the 20-year experience in the hospital. But I feel very myself. So I'm not really concerned with how people see me. I don't really care.
I mean, there's a part of me that does not give a fuck what people think about me.
But yet, while you were in institutionalized, what was that? What was going through your mind?
What do you mean? You have to expand.
What I'm trying to say is, what is that experience like for somebody like you to spend 20 years, and especially the last years of when you were more...
I just explained that.
You were always kind of second-guessing reality,
sure,
checking yourself?
Sure. Especially when you're trying to get out, and they say you can't get out because X, Y, and Z. And you have to stop and think, wait a minute, I'm X, Y, and Z now? Wait, oh, God. You know, how did that happen? And wow. And then you check yourself with your friends. I'd ask other people. They're saying I'm such and such and such. I've said it to you. What do you think about it? They say this, that, and the other thing, but I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, it's like, so you second guess yourself all the time. But in the end, you just gotta, that's what it was in terms of mounting the case to get out. You gotta believe in who you are and who you are not and get the fuck out of there. If you can. They held me from when I was 24 till I was 44. Because I got old. I got old. I mean, in my 30s, they wouldn't let me go. I was wearing spandex. My dick was 12 inches long. I was a superhero. And that scared the shit out of them. I'm fucking people. I'm doing paintings and showing how I'm fucking people while in the paintings, the administration is watching going, oh my God. Yeah, I'm just really flaunting it, man. They couldn't let me go. I was too ferocious. But after 20 years, they didn't let me go. I kind of fought my way out. But still in all, you know, they were planning to hold me until I got old. And that's what they do. Especially if you come in there in your 20s or in your early 30s.
Your roommate you just heard about you.
Yeah, our roommate died. He wasn't going to get out. He killed somebody and then raped her or something, which is terrible. But he felt bad. We did talk. A little bit he did say about it. He always felt bad. But he did his time, and then they found out he was mentally ill, so they put him in a mental hospital. So he's doing double time. And so that kind of burned him a little because he thought he was getting out. And then just when he went for his release, they said, we took these tests and we're sorry, but we're sending you to a mental hospital. So that must have blown his mind. And he was mentally retarded. So how much can he understand other than, I thought I was getting out. Where am I going now? Creedmoor. Oh, my God. Yeah. How do I get out of there? Oh, you'll have to try. Oh, my God. Yeah, so when we would talk about it, he'd have remorse in his own, I hate to say this, in his own mentally retarded way, he did have remorse about the murder and the rape. But he also felt like, he also followed that up with, I did my time. I did my time, and he's still keeping me here. So he understood enough to know that he got screwed.
But this is now what's happening in the state of many different, where a lot of people have done their time,
and they
continue to warehouse them.
Yeah, yeah. Thank God my case wasn't like that. Even though they were warehousing me a little bit, every case is different. That's what they always tell you, every case is different.
Well, you were...
There are some sexual predators who got out. There's one guy, Marcus, who was a sexual predator and killed somebody while he was in jail because he had the teardrops and the whole... He was just like a real piece of work. But a nice guy in his own way. He was mentally retarded too, but not like David, who was really like, duh. Just Marcus was a little... He's MR, but had a sharpness about him, and not so radically MR. But he did his time. He did like 15 years, and he pled down to rape on a lesser charge or something, and then came to Creedmoor for like 5 or 6 years, and got out before me. You know, he got out. Now he's living in a residence somewhere. So you can, you know, depending on...
You've been in with some strange characters.
I've seen some pretty...
And you've been strange yourself.
Well, what does that mean? Of course. I've been sick. So what?
No, I'm just saying, so what is it? How, when you see other people who are melting down, sick.
I think everybody kind of, everybody. It's the pot calling, I don't know, I don't know how to put it or what in a cliche sense, but everybody looks at everybody else and saying, I'm glad I'm not as fucked up as that guy. Even James, your friend, you know, I'm so glad I'm not fucked up like that, you know. And meanwhile, he's really fucked up, you know. So, I don't know. And I had a touch of that, too, when I first came into the system. You know, I wasn't one of the club who walked around with people with heads in their buckets, you know, which there was a club of that. There were quite a few guys who...
Over-medicated?
No, walk around with a head in a bucket
get
there. They kill the person, then chop the person up, then rape the body parts, then put the head in a bucket and walk around the streets and put the head in a... this one guy, two guys, got a locker in Grand Central Station and put the head in the locker, put the bucket with the head in the locker, go get something to eat at Sbarro's or Grace Papaya. Come back, get the bucket, walk around with it, talk to it, walk around, then go put it back. And take it on Staten Island Ferry, talking, show it the Statue of Liberty from the bucket. Yeah, there's just, you know, that was like a thing for a while.
Oh, you're kidding?
The head in the bucket.
The head in the bucket.
The head or a body part. Carrying, walk around with a body part. This guy he hurt somebody and killed her and raped her and then wrapped her up in foil and then took parts of it. Out with them.
There's one guy who fed it to homeless people.
Fed it to the homeless. That was pretty. Yeah, that was pretty gruesome.
Did you know that guy?
I knew that guy. Yeah, I knew that guy. It's pretty gruesome.
And then there was the guy who shit in mailboxes.
Well, that's not so gruesome. That's disgusting, but that's not gruesome.
I mean,
but he was a federal case, because that's a federal crime.
Because he shit in the mailbox.
He had to shit somewhere. He was homeless, and he had no place to shit. And this is before, like, Starbucks. This is, like, maybe early 90s, before Barnes & Noble, Starbucks, before they started being friendly to people coming in and using their shitter. You know, there was a time when you couldn't use people's shitters, or you had a hard way to go. Nowadays, you can go anywhere and shit, which is great. But at that time, he just had a hard way to go. Plus, he smelled, and he had a whole cart of shit with him. Not actual shit, but like garbage, or his belongings. So he had a hard way to go finding some place, and finally he took to shitting in mailboxes, and they caught him one day. You're the guy! And that was it. He had a federal case, and they found out he was insane, homeless and insane, mentally ill, and he's been in Creedmoor ever since.
What was it like being around all of these different guys and you're there.
It was interesting. You know, I wrote a lot about it, and I painted a lot about it, and I'd sing songs about it, but I didn't get too affected by it because I realized that this is the nature of where I'm at, and I had to work on getting out. Don't get too caught up in it. Some people get caught up in it. There's one guy who ran over his neighbor with his car, and he get caught up in the crimes. He was a CPL patient who just got caught up in what everybody did. Maybe that was his response to feeling bad about what he did, or maybe not feeling bad, or who knows what, but that was his response to what he did and how they were treating him. So he would always say, well, this guy did this, and that guy did that, and I went for my level 4 and they wouldn't give it to me because of what I did. But this guy did this, and that guy did that, and I think he may have even found out what I did at some point. And Issa did such and such. And I was like, oh, you piece of shit. You piece of shit. You're going to use me now. Yeah. So that's how he responded to it. And getting caught up in everybody else's issue. But you just keep moving. You just keep moving. That's the best thing to do. Not pay too much attention to the details. And just keep a focus on what you need to do to get out of there, whether it's give them good behavior, or if you're giving them good behavior and they still won't let you go, mounting a good case. And that's what it was for me. For a while, I was giving them good behavior, as best as I could, borrowing a few songs to the administrators or whatever, or paintings of the administration, and compromising positions.
You were sabotaging yourself a little bit.
Maybe a little. I don't know. I was being an artist. I was being, I don't know.
You were being the what-if man.
Yeah.
Super what-if man.
Yeah, well, you know, what if you write a song to the to the director of the hospital?
Hot for the director.
I'm hot for you, baby. Well, that in title only, but if she gets a chance to listen to it, she'd realize that there's a play on the word, and actually, it's not a "I'm hot for you, baby" song, but actually a very touching, loving homage to lost youth and lost innocence. That's what it was. What if you send it to her and she just reads the title and doesn't listen to this? And the what if was, I get screwed. But,
yeah, it only cost you 5 years.
Well, hey, yeah. It's a good experiment.
A good experiment. An experiment.
Experiment in terror.
Terrorizing yourself in the end.
Experiment in terror, yeah.
But I just can't wonder, how do you survive this?
Because people, I'm a survivor, and so people, you'd be surprised what you survive. You'd be surprised. You survived. Look at you. You're 60. God knows what now. I won't say how old, but you're the age you are, and you've had experiences in life where you probably wondered, how the hell did I get out of that? How the hell did you get out of your two marriages?
How did I get into them?
Let alone how did you get out of them? How did you survive that? So we're all survivors. Human beings are very resilient. People have always said, and people, especially mentally ill people who kind of come to a certain level of lucidity, I've heard people often say, you see that doctor over there? If he were in my shoes, he wouldn't last two days in this position. But I don't know. I don't know about that.
Well, what is it? What is it that makes us survive? What is it that makes you survive?
I don't know. I can't say. Knowing that...
But you gave up a few times.
I did, but not for very long. You give up only in that you just kind of go, you just kind of like, you know, sometimes you have to pull back. Sometimes you have to, you know, reboot. Sometimes you have to reboot. You just can't keep it running all the time. Sometimes when it runs hot and starts fucking up, you got to reboot and say, okay, let's turn it off. I give. And then you turn it on again and see what you got and see if you lost anything. And you start again. So.
Well, you've torn up your artwork, haven't you?
I have. I've thrown away some things I wish I hadn't thrown away. I almost threw away Superman on the Rocks and those a lot of very major pieces. I did throw them away. I put them out in the hallway. I did a spring cleaning and said, take them. And thank God there were staff there who said, oh, we'll take them, all right. And they put them in the closet and kept them for me. My old computer, I threw that out. I threw everything out, all my discs, everything. And there's some things like a lot of writings. I had like 20 or 30 notepads of writings. My memoirs, which I had backed up on disc, but these are like the original stuff. And a lot of other writings, a couple of song books, a couple of songs of like my first couple of songs I wrote. All gone. Clothes. Two or three times I threw like whole wardrobes out and walked on in a sheet and sandals because I was Jesus, you know. So, but clothes.
You say that with a very... No, I was Jesus, so I had to walk around with it. What's going on through your mind then?
Well, Jesus doesn't wear jeans. Jesus wears a sheet, a robe, and sandals.
So he doesn't need anything.
All I needed was a robe and sandals.
And what was going through your mind?
Didn't have to worry about what to wear every day. I just every other day I'd wash my sheet. You know, then I'd get the guys upset because I'm walking around naked in sandals. I said, "No, I'm washing my sheet." Get come on, you can't walk around like that. You can't walk around. What's wrong with you? So I'd get another sheet. So I'd have two sheets. Yeah. But then I felt bad having two sheets. I said, "Would Jesus have two sheets?" Would Jesus have two sheets? What would Jesus do?
And your name is
Yes. Isa is the Arabic Islamic translation of Jesus. So that caused a lot of issues.
So you're in the mental hospital, and you're one of the guys. You're not a spectator there.
But in many ways, I was. In many ways, I was a spectator. I kind of always looked at my life as from a spectator's point of view. Kind of that detachment helps me get through it a lot easier, I think.
But that also makes you kind of schizophrenic too, doesn't it?
I don't know if that's schizophrenic. I wouldn't call it that. That's you diagnosing something. I don't think so.
What would you
just
call
makes it? I wouldn't call it schizophrenia. This makes it easier to get through something.
To separate yourself from it.
I don't know if it's a separation or just a little bit of distance. A little bit of distance. It's a difference. It's a difference. It's putting distance so that you don't get so involved and so caught up in the mishigas and the intensity of it. You give yourself distance and look at it from a distance and just go, okay, that's what's happening. This is happening. Okay, I can deal with that. That's how I deal with it. That's what's helped me get by. That's what's helped me survive.
Through
my life.
From growing up.
And that could be what schizophrenia is. That could be schizophrenia. I wouldn't call it that, but it's a survival technique, a survival mechanism that's worked very well for me.
Well, having talked to the guy who founded the clozapine, the drug that is the basis of most psychotropic drugs, he was saying that maybe schizophrenia is a natural state of human beings. I tend to agree with that. Because, look, you go into... The greatest example of schizophrenia I've ever seen is you drive in a car, you hate all pedestrians. You get out of the car, you hate all drivers.
I don't know if that's schizophrenia. I don't want to talk about what schizophrenia is or isn't, because I think you know just as little, if not less.
I probably know less. But I always think about that driver in the car, because I've done that.
I wouldn't say that's schizophrenia. That's schizophrenia.
Well, it's like two different.
I don't quite know what you're trying.
What's your?
No, I don't. But I think you're just kind of like grasping and or just kind of going with something that isn't necessarily what schizophrenia is. Or.
Okay, so maybe I don't know. I'm not saying I know.
I mean, just yeah, it's not about how they say it's a split mind, but that's what it, in its root form what it is, schizophrenia. But I don't know. I don't know if that's you know. So let's
well the wind it up. Point in our conversation where we started last night to think about was on the psychophobia thing. And where I would like us to think about is, you know, you're an artist. I'm an artist. You were concerned yesterday about how, as an artist, you were perceived and your own psychophobia. What do you mean?
I don't think I know what you're saying. You have to be a little more clear.
Well, I mean, okay, so you've spent 20 years in a mental hospital. How do you see other people when you're out, now that you're out? What is your relationship to mental illness? How do you relate to it?
It's an illness. People have an illness. That's like having diabetes, like having heart disease. It's like having anything. Well, why should that define somebody?
So you see people walking down the street.
Why should that define somebody? How do you feel about it? What are you trying to say?
What am I trying to say?
Well, it sounds like you have a preconceived notion.
No, our conversation yesterday.
No, but what? No, I don't think I get where you're coming from.
Well, in thinking about psychophobia, we have just
gone. That's another buzzword, and you got to retire that. That's like
what do you reality. Mean that?
No, please. That's a buzzword, and you just say it, and you'll have to maybe find another way of putting that so that because it's just like it sounds like you're plugging the film without the film being made.
I'm not plugging the
film. It's like you have a title and you're jerry-rigging the conversations to the title. You know what I mean? So
what does it mean to you, psychophobia?
I don't know. What are you trying to say?
I'm just trying to say is that we have experienced similar and different lives. We're friends. We're working on a film or a concept.
No, that's not. Let's just have a conversation. Let's not think about making a film.
No, well, it's not a film. It's a non-linear whatever.
Is it really?
Well, so far it's whatever it is at the moment. We're recording. It's like an audio.
But it's a project.
And the project
you're working towards the project instead of like having a genuine conversation.
Okay, well, the part of the conversation is What do we want people to think about psychophobia? What do you want people to think about?
Psychophobia meaning what?
Meaning our relationship to people, how we think about mental illness and how
buzzwords, man. You're going with buzzwords, and it's like that's the subtitle. The title. Well, what's the title? Well, what does that mean? Then you give me the subtitle, and it's not real. This isn't real.
Okay, it's not real. What would make it real?
No, come on. Now you're getting defensive.
No.
And you're getting defensive because it's good audio. And you're not being real about it.
You're not
answering the question. You're just kind of circumventing.
Well, to me, psychophobia represents how society and how we and individuals look at people who have mental issues.
Is that what psychophobia really is?
It's how we, the stigmatism that we bear intuitively and culturally, society, and there are many places where they hide people who have, because they don't want their other people to think of them just like your mother. Your grandmother would have your mother run up ahead of her and go into the building before she got there because she didn't want to be associated with a dark-skinned child or a person, even though it came from her. I mean, it's that dynamic relationship that we have with ourselves and the world, how we want the world to see us, and yet the world sees us anyway in whatever way it wants to, but we don't have control over that.
Right, so what's the problem?
So the problem is we live in a society that creates a dynamic tension and discards a whole population which is us.
About everything. So whether it's psychophobia or racophobia or anything, sexophobia,
prisonophobia,
or any.
No, I'm just saying.
It's anything. That's. I'm talking like in more real terms than just like you're deracinating. I'm just it's about everything. That's how life is. That's how society is.
Does that work for us?
For who? Us meaning who?
As a society. I mean, I look at the
well, yeah, you're trying, now you're asking questions that I can't answer, and I don't want to answer, because I'm just a cog in the wheel, man. If I can change things in any way I can as a painter, or maybe singing a song or two, or whatever,
I mean, you've been
changing society. How are you changing society?
I'm talking to you. I'm trying to understand this dynamic of you as a person who has been diagnosed, who's on meds, who's been, even when you were in institutionalized, there were people saying, that's really screwed up. In other words, they would judge each other on their level of how their issues that brought them there and what they did and what they didn't do. It's kind of like the dynamics that we have in our own world. We see people who are... In Brazil, when I lived in Brazil, they could tell people who they were by the shoes they wore. The poor only wore those cheap Zoris, and the rich wore the same ones, but they were they had a little thing on top of it. In Africa, there's the people who have flat noses and the people who have pointed noses. In Bosnia, there's the Muslims and the other... there's every culture has an enemy. And maybe that enemy is us, but it's also how we perceive the world around us and how we isolate and make us better. It's kind of like Hitler had the Aryan race and he wanted to purify that. Lots of cultures go through that psychophobia of making somebody less than human. And when you go into war, what are you doing? You're creating a dynamic situation where the other people aren't human. They're bugs. They're the enemy. They're not fit so that you can actually destroy them and destroy yourself at the same time.
Well, they don't look at themselves as destroying themselves. They look at themselves as destroying an enemy.
Right, which is themselves in many ways.
Well, nobody. Very few people look at it like that.
Well, it's an obvious thing. Well, everybody obvious, suffers for that.
It's not as obvious as you might think.
Well, they're convinced that they're right at the time, but look at wars.
I understand, but people don't look at it like that.
No, they don't have the awareness, but maybe that's what psychophobia is about.
More so than psychophobia, it's just maybe you should find a different buzzword to encapsulate this whole feeling that you're talking about, and not just necessarily separate it into the psychophobia, but just the whole stigma of the other, and trying to eliminate the other or separate the other from the true or whatever they think they are, and who are they, and are we a part of they? So it's just a bigger issue than just psychophobia.
Well, I mean, you look at You look at wars. You know, it's said that the trade of kings is in war. That you have these social situations where nations and tribalism and these capitalism, socialism, communism, idealism, all these isms. You know, the reference point I look at is we think they're going to bring us together, all these cultures. You know, we belong to one religion, you belong to another religion. Well, you know, so maybe the most important thing about psychophobia is believing. We want to belong. And the others don't belong. And why don't they belong? Because they don't look like us.
Well, there needs to always be another, I guess, in society. There always needs to be another.
Well, it's the way it seems like it works. But who does that work for?
Well, yeah.
It works for the top down, for those up at the top.
Yeah.
Not us, because we're just going
along. But I don't know. Even you know, there are even those who are downtrodden who have people that they can turn their noses up on and look down on.
Well, it gives them a sense of sure. What? What does it give them a sense of? They're special. They're endowed. They're the better class. The better, you know, I grew up white. I can't help that. You know, my folks were Jewish. My father used to have to fight to go to school and come back from school. My mother was traumatized as a little kid because some little kid said, "You're Jewish. You shouldn't be holding a flag of that nation that you're born into." She didn't know anything. I mean, I think a lot of it is propaganda and stuff that we're kind of force-fed as kids and as we grow into. We're born into a society. We don't know any different. You know, you're fed this stuff, whether you go to a religious organization or whether you go to a school. So, what's this? You want to cut it off? No. Oh, wrap it up? You want to wrap it up? He wants to wrap it up. So wrap it up. What is psychophobia to you?
I don't think it's about psychophobia. You just wrapped it up. That's what I'm saying. You got to know when to be a little more professional.
Be more professional.
Because this is just ridiculous. This whole sidebar nonsense. Sometimes you gotta know when to really hit your marks and get the fuck out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Now who says what? Whose mark is the mark? And you gotta make a phone call. That's where you're at. You got somebody texting you.
No. I'm texting. I do have to make a phone call.
You do have to make a phone call. You do have to make a phone call. In the middle of all this.
No, it's over. You said what you had to. You wrapped it up.
Yeah, but
you got to know when to wrap. You got to know. You just got to know when.
Now,
you can't just go on and on and on, because then it just becomes like an exercise in futility and boring and just like, what the fuck are they talking about now? Okay, yeah, that was nice like 20 minutes ago. That was nice like 22 hours ago. But where are we going with this now? Just got to know when it's like, okay, I said what I had to say, and it's a good capper, good cherry on the sundae. Now let's eat the sundae. Not put more fudge and bananas and whipped cream and nuts on something that's already had fudge and banana and whipped cream and nuts. Just got to know when the sundae is done, eat the sundae and get the fuck out.
But it's Thursday. Okay, so shall we call it a day today?
Yes.
Do you have any final thoughts?
No.
Why not?
What do you mean, why not?
Why not?
Come on.
You are really hot to make this phone call.
No, but I'm just, you said, you just got to know when it's good. You got to know when it's good. And you can't just, this is
so
just.
So unless you have the last word.
Oh, no, you should just edit all this stuff out and just end it where you, because this is just nonsense.
This is nonsense.
This is nonsense.
Nonsense.
Who's serious? I'm serious.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll end it here.
Yes.
Do you want a parting word?
Good night.
Good night. It's daylight. What time is it? It's, okay, so we shall visit another time, maybe, and as he makes his phone call. Goodbye.